Lecture 11, Musonius Rufus, the Roman Socrates.
Our comparison in the last lecture between Cicero and Seneca on the subjects of friendship and old age showed us how differences of approach still obtain between Platonist and Stoic during our period, even when the focus was on the moral character of everyday life. Cicero, we saw, was more expansive and open, Seneca more rigorous and controlled. Although Cicero was eclectic and tended toward Stoicism, he was basically Platonic in his outlook. And although Seneca was attracted to Epicureanism, he nevertheless, at root, was Stoic in his viewpoint. In this session, we will meet another philosopher who is also Stoic to his toenails, although he is very much influenced by that rigorous stream in Greco-Roman philosophy known as Cynicism. The man called, in antiquity, the Roman Socrates, Musonius Rufus. In contrast to Cicero and Seneca, whose lives are well known and whose works are both voluminous and extant, Seneca's younger contemporary, Musonius Rufus, whose dates are around 30 to 100 of the Common Era, remains obscure, even though his reputation among other philosophers in antiquity was extraordinarily high. Only the bare outlines of his life are known to us, and many of the details are in dispute. We don't even know where he was born. Philostratus, in his Life of Apollonius of Tyana, that first century Neopythagorean philosopher whom we've mentioned earlier, says that a certain Musonius of Babylon was exiled under Nero and put in prison and was facing death. And if that attribution of Musonius as being from Babylon is correct, then he was from very far in the eastern part of the empire, or really even outside of the empire. But we have no other evidence that confirms that identification or to support it. We do know from other sources that he opposed Nero and the tyranny of Nero and was exiled by him in the year 65. And he may also have been exiled a second time under the emperor Vespasian. He is like Socrates and his own Musonius's own student Epictetus in that he left no writings of his own. He was not a literary philosopher. Rather, he taught students in the classroom in the dialogical manner of the diatribe. The diatribe is this give-and-take manner of teaching with students, which resembles the dialogue of Plato, except that it's real life. It's not a literary form. It is and it's sharper than Plato's dialogue, a little bit more confrontative with students, a little sharper, a little tougher. That's the method of teaching that Musonius and then his student Epictetus used, and therefore only fragments of his teaching remain. In particular, we have extant 21 fragmentary treatises that were recorded by his student Lucius, and then some 32 other sayings attributed to Musonius Rufus that are preserved in Stobaeus's Greek anthology from the 6th century. A sign of Musonius's obscurity to us is that he is the only one of the authors that we are dealing with in this course who cannot be found in the Loeb Classical Library. In order to read Musonius Rufus, one must consult Cora Lutz's book by that title, Musonius Rufus, the Roman Socrates, which contains both the Greek text and an English translation of his extant fragments. But despite remaining obscure to us, he was extravagantly admired by other ancient philosophers. Julian the Cynic mentions him in the same breath with Socrates, and the Christian theologian Origen ranks him with Heracles, Odysseus, and Socrates as models of excellence of life. High praise from Origen. Perhaps his greatest contribution to posterity was that he was the teacher of Epictetus. And we will deal with Epictetus in three lectures later in this course. Epictetus, in his own diatribes, contains a handful of memories of his master that give a vivid impression both of his character and of his teaching. His character appears as hard, demanding, even flinty, and his teaching appears equally tough as a form of stoicism and cynicism. He is obviously a teacher that demands of his students that they get it right, who challenges them, who engages in give and take with them in a sharp dialectic, and who teaches by means of very crisp aphorisms and sharply worded rebuttals to his students' positions. I want to read the remaining fragments of his sayings that we find in Epictetus, because although some of them are obscure and difficult to figure out what exactly he's after, they give you a sense of his own voice, and this is the only place that we hear his own voice. Because when we read the literary fragments, basically we're getting a student's transcriptions. And if you've ever read a student's notes of a teacher, you know that something is sometimes lost in that transition. Epictetus contains this memory. Thrasea used to say, Thrasea was another student, "I would rather be killed today than banished tomorrow." Student expressing a preference. "I would rather be killed today than banished tomorrow." What then did Rufus say to him? Rufus is always the name by which Epictetus refers to his teacher. Rufus says, "If you choose death as the heavier of two misfortunes, what folly of choice! But if as the lighter, who has given you the choice? Are you not willing to practice contentment with what has been given you?" Now, what's the point of this? The point is that for the true Stoic, there ought not to be a preference between banishment and death. Rather, the true Stoic, in Rufus's response, is somebody who adapts himself to whatever fortune presents. It is not in their position to make a choice between death and banishment. Now, I remind you, this is a different Stoic than Seneca. If you remember from the last class, Seneca's answer would have been clear, wouldn't it? Seneca's answer would have been, it's better to commit suicide than to experience shame. But this is not Rufus's position. Rufus is more radical in his Stoicism and less affected by Epicureanism than Seneca. For Rufus, there is almost a pure passivity in the face of what fortune presents you. On another occasion, one of Epictetus' students made a mistake in logic. He didn't follow the reasoning properly in a certain classroom exercise, and he is rebuked by Epictetus. And Epictetus responds, "Well, if I err in these matters, I haven't murdered my father, have I?" Big deal, in other words. Epictetus responds, "Slave," they're really gentle with their students, "slave, pray, where was there, in this case, a father for you to murder? What then have you done, you ask? You have committed what is the only possible error in this matter. Indeed, this is the very remark that I made to Rufus when he censured me for not discovering the one omission in a certain syllogism." Now he's remembering when he was a student. "I made a mistake in a syllogism when Rufus was in the classroom. Well," said I, "it isn't as bad as if I had burned the Capitol." And Rufus answered, "Slave, the omission here is the Capitol." This is pure Stoicism. To make a mistake in a little thing is as bad as making a mistake in a big thing. So that if you make a mistake in logic, you're likely to end up murdering your father. If you omit the proper step in a syllogism, it is as bad in logic as burning the Capitol is in politics. This is very rigorous teaching. Likewise, Rufus was accustomed to say, to test me, "Your master is going to do such and such to you." Notice that he's speaking to Epictetus, who in fact was a slave. And so Rufus is saying, the person who owned you is going to do such and such to you. And Epictetus responds, it's but the lot of man. It's a good student. And Rufus answers, what then? Am I to go on and petition him not to do something when I can get the same result from you? For in fact, it is foolish and superfluous to try to obtain from another that what one can get from oneself. This is terribly obscure, but what he's really getting at is that Epictetus is being a good student here because he is not expressing a preference. If his master does something, so be it. If his master doesn't do something, so be it. There's no need to go off and beg the master not to do X or Y for something. Epictetus says, it's not an easy thing to prevail upon young students, and it's not easy to catch soft cheese with fish hooks. But the gifted young men, even if you try to turn them away, they take hold of reason all the more firmly. And so also Rufus, for the most part, tried to dissuade people, that is, from studying with him, using such efforts to dissuade them as a means of discriminating between those who were gifted and those who were not. For he used to say, just as a stone, even if you throw it upwards, will fall downwards to earth by virtue of its constitution, so also is the gifted man. The more one beats him back, the more he inclines toward his natural object. As a good Stoic, Rufus preached providence. Somebody came up to him and said, well, Galba the emperor has been assassinated. This happened in the year 69. Is the universe governed now by providence? But he replied, did I ever, even in passing, take the case of Galba as the basis for an argument that the universe is governed by providence? This is a simple exercise in logic. That which has not been used for a demonstration cannot be used as a rebuttal of that demonstration. The final statement in Epicurus about his teacher Musonius Rufus happens in that same diatribe that I quoted in an earlier presentation, in which Epictetus compares the philosopher's lecture hall with a hospital, saying, man, you're sick when you come in here, and this is not about giving you pleasure, but about giving you pain so that you can be cured. But here is a student remembering his own teacher. If the philosopher's discourse doesn't have the effect of making students squirm by making them realize their faults and how they need to improve, it is lifeless. And so is the speaker himself. Rufus used to say, if you have nothing better to do than to praise me, then I am speaking to no purpose. Wherefore, and here's Epictetus remembering him, wherefore he spoke in such a way to each of us as we all sat there, that we all thought that someone had gone to Rufus and told him of our faults. So effective was his grasp of what men actually do. So vividly did he set before each man's eyes his particular weakness. Now, I am terribly fond of these reminiscences of Musonius Rufus because, as you will learn when we reach Epictetus, Epictetus is one of my great heroes. And it's wonderful to think about Epictetus learning from Musonius Rufus and looking back on his own teacher and, in fact, remembering him as the great physician of the soul. We have pitifully little remaining of Musonius Rufus, but I would like to share with you some points of interest from the fragments that remain to us that reveal his Stoic cynic tendencies. In fragment 8, which is entitled That Kings Should Also Study Philosophy, Rufus places emphasis on the need for self-control in one who demands self-control of subjects. He begins by saying it is essential for a king to exercise self-control over himself and demand self-control of his subjects, to the end that sober rule and seemly submission, there shall be no wantonness on the part of either. For the ruin of the ruler and the citizen alike is wantonness. Now, what's going on here is that Musonius Rufus is giving a particular Stoic turn to Plato's understanding of the philosopher king. In order to really rule properly, one must be a philosopher. In order to properly control others by ruling the state, one must be in control of oneself. And the only subject that studies self-control is philosophy. It teaches one to be above pleasure and greed, to admire thrift and avoid extravagance. It trains one to have a sense of shame, to control one's tongue, and it produces discipline, order, and courtesy, and in general, what is fitting in action and in bearing. If an ordinary person has these things, it gives them dignity and respect. But he says, if they are present in a king, then they make him preeminently godlike and worthy of reverence. For the Stoic, the philosopher is a king, and a king should therefore be a philosopher. Now, what's important here is that both Musonius Rufus and Epictetus were read carefully by Marcus Aurelius, who himself tried to become, as Roman emperor in the second century, a philosopher king, and we will examine their influence on that ruler. In fragment number 11, Musonius takes up the question of what means of livelihood is appropriate for a philosopher. And he uses agriculture as a noble exercise of virtue and a means of instruction through example and imitation. The backdrop to this is for you to understand that in antiquity, the worth of employments was not measured by how much money one made, but rather whether or not one's activity was noble or ignoble. Cicero, for example, when he is discussing the kinds of occupations that befit a gentleman, excludes the kinds of things that don't require a lot of intelligence and in which vice may be practiced, for example, cheating and fraud and so forth. So he calls all of these things the vulgar trades, wholesale merchants, people who are mechanics, fishmongers, butchers, cooks, poulterers, and fishermen. And obviously everybody who acts in the theater and is a member of the corps de ballet, as he says. All of these people, these are all vulgar professions. On the other hand, those things that require more intelligence, to be an architect, to be a doctor, to be a teacher, these are proper for the gentleman. And then perhaps surprising to us, Cicero concludes, but of all the occupations by which gain is secured, none is better than agriculture. None is more profitable, none more delightful, none more becoming to a free man. Now, it must be remembered, of course, that Cicero spent his life as a politician and wouldn't know one end of a hoe from another. But so what he has in mind as agriculture is being part of the landed gentry and watching one's slaves work the field and sitting back in the villa and perhaps sipping a mint julep or something and enjoying agriculture at that level. Remember, one of the advantages of old age in his work on De Senectute was, you know, to be able to practice agriculture, by which he obviously meant something like tending tulips or something, or roses. But Musonius Rufus is much more typically Stoic in this regard. He says, perhaps somebody might say that it's preposterous for an educated man who is able to influence the young in the study of philosophy to work the land and do manual labor just like a peasant. Isn't this unworthy? Isn't this a shameful occupation? He said it would be too bad if that kind of work actually prevented you from studying philosophy. But since that's not so, pupils would seem to me to be rather benefited by not meeting with their teacher in the city or listening to formal lectures in classroom or taking part in discussions, but by listening to him teaching in the fields as he works, demonstrating by his own labor the lessons that philosophy teaches, that one should endure hardships and suffer the pains of labor with his own body rather than depend on another for his sustenance. So what's going to prevent a student from learning if he is working alongside of his teacher as they're digging or hoeing or picking weeds, you see. For those who teach philosophy well do not need many words, because the essence of philosophy is not words, but doing. And so the student who watches his master exemplifying the virtues of the philosophical life, which, notice, are independence, not depending on other people for your food, the willingness to engage in hard training, and the willingness to suffer. In this, the life of Stoicism is wonderfully summarized. In fragment 16, what is the best provision of old age? Musonius argues that philosophy is not only a matter of knowledge, but also of practice, done in obedience to the call of God. This is only a portion of a larger tractate, which obviously is on the subject of old age and what you should do in youth to prepare for old age. What's fascinating here is that he's talking to a young man who says, "My daddy won't let me study philosophy. You know, I can't. I'd love to go to philosophy school, but my father won't let you." He says, "Your father may forbid you, but Zeus, the father of all gods and men, bids you and exhorts you to do otherwise. His command and law is that men be just and honest, beneficent, temperate, high-minded, superior to pain, superior to pleasure, free of all envy and malice. To put it briefly, the law of Zeus bids man to be good, but being good is the same as a philosopher. So if you obey your father, you're just going to obey the will of a man. If you follow the life of philosophy, you will obey the will of God." Musonius Rufus obviously belongs to that group of philosophers who regards the philosophic calling as a response to God's call. And he goes on to tell the young man that even if your daddy locks you up in a closet or keeps you from going to school, he can't prevent you from studying philosophy, because it is a matter of your own choice. And if you're thinking for yourself, you're already becoming a philosopher. So if you, in fact, construe the constraints under which your father puts you as an opportunity for self-control, for making your own judgments and so forth, you're already studying philosophy. Philosophy does not consist in wearing a worn cloak or growing long hair or deviating from the ordinary practices of the average man. That's well enough for professionals, he says. But philosophy does not consist in that. It consists rather in thinking out what is a man's duty and meditating upon it. And so he says this can be done by anybody in any circumstances. Now, in antiquity, philosophers had a variety of views, just as religious teachers did, concerning the innate goodness or badness of humans. Musonius Rufus, like most moralists, tends toward an optimistic view, that humans are capable of being good. In fact, he argues that they have a natural tendency toward being good. In fragment 15, he argues that man is born with an inclination to virtue. And that virtue is not a specialized art, but one available to all and, in fact, desired by all. And because he has that optimistic view about the human capacity to be good, he's correspondingly severe in the demands that he makes on humans. So he says that that we can all live our lives free from error and nobly. Not that one can and one cannot, but everybody. Being virtuous is not a matter of a profession. It's not like being a physician who must be free from error, or a musician who is the only one who knows how to play the lyre. In the conduct of life, he says, it is no longer only the philosopher we expect to be free from error, although he's the only one who studies virtue, but all people alike, including those who have never given any attention to virtue. And he has a kind of an interesting proof for this. He says everybody, if they are asked whether they are stupid or smart, will say, "I'm smart." If you ask them whether they're just or unjust, they'll say that they're just. If you ask them whether they're temperate or intemperate, they'll think that they're temperate. If you ask them whether they're good or bad, they think that they're good. And of course, we all know sociopaths for whom that's obviously not true, but nevertheless, sociopaths will say, "Yeah, I'm a good person." And Musonius Rufus takes this as a kind of evidence that, in fact, this is a kind of an innate self-awareness and desire among humans. And because of this human capacity to be good, Musonius is very demanding. And this is found above all in his sexual ethics. Musonius Rufus, in fragment 12 on sexual indulgence, provides the most stringent sexual morality that we know in antiquity. It's paralleled only by Christianity and only barely by Christianity. I'd like to read part of this to show you just how severe this is. Not the least significant part of the life of luxury, he says, and self-indulgence, lies also in sexual excess. For example, those who lead such a life crave a variety of loves, not only lawful, but also unlawful ones as well. Not women alone, but also men. Sometimes they pursue one love and sometimes another. And not being satisfied with those that are available, pursue those that are rare and inaccessible and invent shameful intimacies, all of which constitute a grave indictment of manhood. And remember, he's always talking to men. So here's what he thinks. Sexual intercourse is justified only when it occurs in marriage and is indulged for the sake of begetting children. It's the only time it's lawful. It's unjust and unlawful when it is mere pleasure-seeking, even in marriage. Now, this is a level of stringency which is profound. Anything outside of that, even within marriage, is to be regarded as wrong. And then he goes on and talks about, of course, then, obviously, if you're committing adultery or if you are having an affair, and he singles out above all, if you are exploiting your slave mates, that is a kind of a wickedness. And he says the proof of that is that nobody does it in public. Everybody keeps that kind of behavior private, which means that they're ashamed of it. And he goes on extensively talking in particular about the exploitation of female slaves. Remember, in antiquity, the master of slaves had total right over the life and the actions of slaves. They were property. And so it was infamous the way in which male slave owners would exploit females sexually. And Musonius Rufus says, this is wantonness, this is shameful, this above all should not be done. He said, think about what you would feel if your wife did the same thing with a slave. And he tries to bring them to an understanding of shame. Now, Musonius's attitude toward women generally was unusually egalitarian for antiquity, as shown by fragment 3. That women also should study philosophy. And his teaching has to be put in the context of general male hostility toward women's emancipation and participation in civic life in the early empire. I've mentioned before that in certain quarters, especially the wealthy, women were gaining a certain amount of emancipation, especially in terms of the rights to hold property and the rights to divorce. And this was met with considerable resistance, either in the form of the sort of casual sexism of calling people women silly women and calling people worse than women and so forth, and also the sort of savage misogyny that we find in Juvenal's satire number 6, which is just a flagrant attack on women in every respect. But against that backdrop, Musonius Rufus, like Seneca, remember from last session, says that women as well as men have received from the gods the gift of reason, which we use in dealings with one another and by which we judge whether a thing is right or wrong, good or bad. Likewise, women have the same senses as men. Women also have the natural inclination toward virtue and the capacity for acquiring it. And the nature of women no less than men is to be pleased by good and just acts and to reject the opposite of these. Now remember how liberating this philosophical view is among Stoics against the backdrop of Plato and Aristotle, who regarded women as failed men, as fundamentally inferior to men. So Musonius Rufus puts them on a level plane. And he goes on to show how in their social setting, they need prudence to be good housekeepers. They need temperance to be chaste and self-controlled and to control their temper, especially with slaves. They need to have justice, the virtue of justice, in order to be a blameless life partner and a sympathetic helpmate and to be an untiring defender of husband and children and to be free of greed and arrogance. And finally, that she should have courage in order to resist people who would manipulate her, exploit her, and so forth. So women are capable of reason. They are capable of virtue. They should study philosophy. But he concludes that this is not so that they can run around and belong to philosophical schools and analyze syllogism as a waste of their time. It is so that they can learn philosophy in order better to fulfill their position in life. He concludes, finally, the teachings of philosophy exhort the woman to be content with her lot and to work with her hands.